Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Universal Love Movement. This is your host, Dr. Carl S. Moore. This podcast show has this special series on accessing ability, and I'm super excited and delighted to welcome a really wonderful, a new colleague, but a trusted one at that, Dr. Logan Jin, who's the Assistant Director of STEM Education for the Sheridan Center at Brown University. Did I introduce you correctly there, Logan? Is that you want
to? That's correct. Yeah, I'm really happy to be joining you here, Kyle.
Yeah, no problem. Other titles you go by, other accolades, superhuman, you know, those types of things.
Yeah, you did a great job, yeah, describing me. But I'm Assistant Director of STEM here at Brown. Before that, I was working on my doctoral dissertation at Arizona State University, working with students with disabilities in STEM education. So, really, really thrilled to be joining you here and talking about, accessing ability.
Well, yeah, and you just mentioned, you know, in terms of your studies, I'm super excited to view this topic through, there are two like lenses here. One, of course, through the conversation traditionally known as disability, but then also the STEM element. It's super fascinating, and we'll see where it intersects and where it does not. But you know, when we had our first conversation, what I really admired about our conversation is we were on the same frequency, I guess I would say, around an asset-based approach to ability, right? And even the use of the word disability being, you know, very popular and common. So that's one of the initial starting points that I want to start at here. Maybe it's not like we can rekindle our conversation that we had on this shuttle bus, right?
Yeah.
But when it comes to like an asset-based approach, this is like the kind of the broad question, and we'll get specific. What do you say to that in terms of where do you think we are, and what are some of your thoughts? Because we're still using the word disability versus like differently abled. And for me, it's always been something that, you know, nuances are important. So what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, and I think there is, yeah, some, as you mentioned, some nuance around that. And I think, it's an open conversation, about language and what people prefer to use. I'm one that isn't necessarily afraid to use the term disability. And I think I have, pride in being someone with a disability.
Right.
But I do like to, as you were mentioning, kind of reframe the conversation around, instead of kind of thinking about limitation, thinking about, possibility. And as you mentioned, kind of asset-based approaches. So, so one thing kind of thinking about, what people with disabilities bring to certain settings, bring to conversations, bring to science, for example, given my background, really thinking about the possibility of what it means to bring people with disabilities into a setting and a circumstance, as opposed to what we've typically been thinking about historically is, kind of the exclusion of people with disabilities. And, and we can get, as you said, get more specific, but, thinking about science, for example, and what possibilities there are when we bring in a new group who typically have been kind of marginalized from science, and really thinking about, all the possibilities, the discoveries, the opportunity that is there when you bring in someone, essentially new to the fold. But
yeah, I love that. I mean, everything you stated, from the part about language and it being not this polarized thing like you shouldn't or you should, but and even claiming there's a term for it where you reclaim or you claim some type of term that could actually have whatever meaning and as a positive source of identity. I forget what the term is for that, but what you had mentioned at the last piece there is huge, because there's so much more innovation that comes through necessity or comes from, when you have these new lenses and that were excluded before and into spaces, you can have even much more innovation. So that's exciting. The possibilities is huge. I'm gonna underline and bold the possibilities part of what you just mentioned. So I really love that.
Yeah, and you know, as you were talking, and as we've been discussing, as you know, this asset-based approach of bringing in people with disabilities brings new ideas, new perspectives, mm-hmm. You know, essentially new innovation, as you mentioned, and it really kind of is a chance for new discovery, right? I mean, you know, bringing in people with disabilities who may think about a problem differently, or may have different lived experiences or perspectives that, you know, otherwise haven't been included, can really be an opportunity for change and difference. Based on, you know, as you were mentioning, some of my doctoral studies and such, I did some qualitative interviews of students with disabilities, and one that struck me was I interviewed a student with autism who was doing autism related research, and you know, was really able to contribute to his research team in a way that no one, you know, without autism or without that kind of shared experience would be able to. And that was really something that has stuck out to me and kind of continues to stick out to me, is like, you know, if we don't include people who may be studying the same types of you know, situations, issues, et cetera, that we're thinking about, you know, can really lead to, you know, misconceptions, etc. But the possibilities are you know, essentially endless when we do think about including you know, the added perspective. So
yeah, I love that, Logan. You know, it's, we're missing out right? We're missing out on the possibilities, right? If we don't.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, historically we have been, you know, so I'm you know, in many ways optimistic about kind of what is possible when we do think about you know, the assets of including people with disabilities.
Well, you know, that's another underlying quote there, the optimistic about what is possible. And I think, well, you and I, you know, in terms of the show and me making, I was doing the Universal Love Movement podcast, and I decided to do this specific series because of me also being optimistic about the possibilities of what people can do. And, you know, to play on words, right? Accessing ability, right? So that's to the spirit of it, Logan. And I really do think there's so much more. And there's another episode out there that first people can click on in terms of like the type of mindset that's needed, right? To actually access their, or leverage their, whether it be classified as a disability or their ability to do new things, or even view other people as being capable. So it's an entire conversation that is a nuance that is super exciting to dig into, you know, for us. And yeah, and I'm sorry, I think I caught a thought there. Were you going to say something?
Yeah, I was just going to add that. Yeah, you know, it's about, you know, perspective and mindset, as you were mentioning, and I think it's mindset of both, you know, individuals with disabilities, but also, you know, those that want to welcome in folks with disabilities kind of into these, you know, contexts and situations, right? And really thinking about the value added that people with disabilities bring to a team setting or, a research group, or, you know, to a workplace, et cetera, right? It's really thinking about, yeah, what value folks with disabilities add. And there's work on, you know, how diverse teams, you know, are better at problem solving and things like that. Yes. And really thinking about diversity of ability or disability, right? You know, and kind of that added layer of diversity and inclusion, right? You know, can really, really, you know, add an additional layer of value to these types of settings.
Right. I love the additional layer of value, so folks recognize that you're going to enhance, you know, you're going to enhance things. And going back to what you mentioned earlier, versus it being like, you know, oh, let's just include these folks now, or it's actually going to. I remember when I was doing inclusive teaching in some of my earlier years, it was like there was this notion of watering down things that it needed to be. And now, you know, I don't know, I have no idea of the percentage of the population where we're at, but now it's, at least in more circles, it's seen as, oh, wow, you are, inclusive teaching is effective teaching, or you are enhancing and magnifying the ways when you add, like you said, add more voices. In a work setting that you just mentioned is huge. So just to make sure that I'm thorough on, we're being thorough on this, what would you say, how do I phrase this? How do you think we can promote that asset-based approach and traditional views, from traditional views that promote this shift that we're talking about? How do you think we can specifically promote it more? Maybe it's like one in the workplace and one in education. Any of your ideas? Because you mentioned what is already happening, and I think people can glean, but I want to make sure that give you the space for that.
Yeah, and I think you were touching on some of it as well, is that we, you know, we make an assumption, you know, that that it could be, you know, the norm should be to include right. everyone, right? And, you know, kind of thinking about inclusive teaching, or, you know, universal design for learning, for example, you know, kind of trying to teach to as many people as possible and include as many people as possible, I think is one approach. I think there is some, you know, perhaps hesitancy, and I know it does take, you know, time and effort, for example, to kind of think ahead and think about, you know, what accommodations folks might need, or, you know, what access needs people might have, in whether it be a workplace or a classroom. So I think, you know, I will be, you know, pragmatic and saying that, you know, it can be challenging, and, you know, it needs to be, you know, kind of forward thinking and, you know, looking ahead in terms of kind of what, if you're designing a course, for example, kind of what areas might folks run into challenges, or, you know, what barriers might someone have in a workplace setting. So I think, you know, there needs to be some forward thinking and kind of thought about that. But I think, you know, I would really like the shift of the conversation to be, you know, kind of that value added piece outweighs the challenges that you might run into, and, you know, and if there needs to be you know, some additional thinking or conversation around, you know, what does it look like to access this, you know, those conversations ideally would happen proactively, but, you know, when there does run into a challenge, you know, you're there to kind of combat them, and, you know, and folks without disabilities or folks kind of in those settings can kind of be, you know, allies and kind of supporters of those challenges that may come up. So I won't say that it will come without challenge or without, you know, time and effort, but I think, you know, that time and effort is outweighed by the possibility of kind of what can happen when you do introduce new people to the setting.
No, that's wonderful. And I really do appreciate the pragmatism there in terms of, hey, we know that this is not a just do it. There is some effort and commitment and you know, what's interesting about the time thing is that you have it where there are two things that you mentioned, the contrast. First, the contrast or the challenges, that actually makes things even better. Like when you work through a challenge, you're stronger. So there's an opportunity there, going back to your opportunities piece. And then the time, it is our responsibility, and many of, I would say as all humankind, you know, humankind's responsibility, but at least as leaders and educators, to actually take the time. This is what we're signing up for, you know? You're signing up to do your best to think about all of those, as much as you can ahead of time, and going drill into what you're saying more, understanding that you can't think of everything. And then on all ends, we have to recognize folks are doing as best as they knew how to do at that time, and there's a dialogue part. So there's a lot there. And I caught another thought bubble, even though
Sorry. No, and you know, and we've we've had conversations around, you know, universal design frameworks and universal design for learning. But, you know, and you know, in many ways, you know, that's the theory of universal design makes a ton of sense. And,
right,
you know, really trying to reduce as many barriers as possible, but also knowing that there are going to be some, you know, unforeseen barriers that do come up. And in those situations, you know, kind of being advocates, being allies, you know, being on hand to kind of assist with those, and, you know, using those situations and opportunities to mitigate, you know, kind of future situations of coming up as well. So, and kind of learning from that to kind of create an even more universally designed framework, you know, for a setting or a classroom, right? And also sharing some of those experiences, I think, is another thing that can be really helpful in these settings.
I love it. There, in the iteration and the expansion and being a part of this growth, the growth narratives and these possibilities for society. I would love to hear more of, whether it's like case studies or stories or any personal stories around this. And one of the areas that I shared, I don't know if I shared on one of these podcasts, is around how technology has helped me and as it relates to my learning or even my capabilities. You know, going back to that question of what I had posed in terms of how do we challenge or how do we have more of an asset-based, you know, approach, whether it's in classes, but then also in work settings. And technology, when I was doing my dissertation, it actually helped me. I was using Dragon Dictation, and I was using like this feature on my MacBook at the time. I don't know if it was Dragon or my Mac, where it was allowing me to listen to and catch some of the editing. So I know technology, and some of this was assistive technology that I activated on my iPhone later that I use, you know, this is before talk to text and speak text was like as popular. I've been using some of that to actually really help, you know, challenge even traditional views on how my brain works in terms of my ability to get things done or to edit or whatever. And I know that there's tons out there traditionally in terms of people's view of, okay, assistive technology for this specific group of individuals. And now we know that with technology, you know, there is assistive technology, and that's like one of the underpinnings of this whole accessing ability. Where's the boundary? Because there are folks that can access new abilities, right? Accessing ability, no pun intended, through AI or something like that. So my specific question, and I just would love you to riff on whatever comes up, would be when we look at like in the context of education and then also the workplace, we can speak to both. What would be the, how would you see the relationship between ability and accessing these technological tools? You had mentioned something earlier that was like right on the mark with this, but I forget at the moment. What is that relationship? Where is it going? What comes up for you when hearing these things?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I think it's an open question, an open conversation too. You were speaking, you know, kind of anecdotes or things. I think both in my research, my own experience that kind of come to mind is really thinking about how some of these assistive technologies can be kind of normalized, and that, you know, as you were mentioning, you know, that things that are things like things that folks with and without disabilities are using. And it almost comes back to, in some ways, kind of universal design type framework. But, you know, and I think actually, and for better or for worse, that in some ways the pandemic has normalized some of these sorts of things. So some things that come to mind are Zoom captions for Zoom meetings, for example, or captioning for Zoom meetings, and that, you know, simply turning on your captions, you know, is an accessibility feature that works for everyone that folks, you know, that used to otherwise have face-to-face meetings might not have had access to. Something like a work from home, what we would call quote unquote an accommodation, you know, actually turns out to work for people, again, with and without disabilities. And some of these things that we didn't think were necessarily possible can be, you know, particularly helpful for individuals with disabilities. Going back to, you know, an education example, in some of my interviews with students, something like a take-home exam or an exam that doesn't have a, you know, a specific time limit or a, you know, a let's say an hour time limit on it, for example, but instead giving, you know, students, you know, a weekend or, you know, a week to submit an assignment or an exam, you know, can be seen, you know, as an accommodation, can also kind of be seen as a, you know, accessibility feature of a course that we might have not have thought about, you know, had we not had to, you know, face these situations of, you know, being remote and you know, not being able to necessarily have kind of face-to-face interaction that that we've you know, faced during the pandemic. So I think with the challenges, you know, opportunities have arisen there. And what I like to see, and I think we're starting to see some of this, but, you know, kind of making some of these, what we used to see as accommodations, kind of more normalized as just features of what it means to be in a 21st century, either education or kind of workplace environment.
I love the, yeah, normalizing. And drilling into that normal, you probably provided a lot of really great depth and texture there, so I appreciate it. And that the normalizing, what do you think that normalizing is going to do for, let's say, for the world? It always sounds so grand, but we are talking globally, right? When it's normalized, what type of a, you know, impact does that have when it's some of these features that were for specific, you know, groups or populations are normalized, or for individuals with disability, if you have these features that are being used, what does that do to the culture?
Yeah, and I think normalizing it is a first step in kind of mitigating what it might necessitate in terms of reducing barriers to access. And I think one thing we know, you know, based on research and otherwise, is it can be really challenging to advocate and self-advocate for particular accommodations and needs. So, you know, kind of reducing the activation energy, if you will, to ask for a particular accommodation. But if, you know, if this is something that's expected, or, you know, as we're saying, kind of normalized as part of an environment, you know, that's just kind of one less barrier, one less thing to you know, as someone with a disability, one less thing to worry about, or one less thing to ask for, you know, and then we can really start thinking about, you know, kind of what is next, what is possible, kind of what is beyond that. And, you know, instead of spending, you know, my time or my mental, right, you know, kind of focusing on
energy costs here.
Right. You know, my, as I mentioned, you know, kind of the activation energy, but also, you know, just the time and effort spent on removing a barrier, as opposed to my time and effort spent on, you know, a solution to a problem. So,
well, Logan, that people, that activation energy is a real thing, and people are not always aware of the tax, right, that the multiple compounding barriers have on folks, depending upon, you know, their positionality and, you know, intersection of all that comes with or whatever the task is requiring in the setting. Like, there's so many like layers here. So I really do appreciate that you drilling into that, because a world where more people feel like they belong more often, right? You know, is one of the things that I'm super excited about. And that's part of the spirit of what I want to promote. And speaking of belonging, when we think about STEM, right? And extending, because, you know, there's there are folks that don't, it's often seen as challenging, and there are folks that may seem limited. And so maybe the very specific question, a good one would be to really drill it, you know, kind of connect to what we're talking about. How can the tools and resources, whether it be both physical, intellectual, or whatever area, provide greater access to this conversation in STEM, or what is happening in STEM that's related to how we're on this kind of frequency on this lane that we're on, where we know that there's more that can be done proactively.
You know? Yeah, I'm really glad that you asked that, and really glad that we can kind of circle back to this part of the conversation, because you know, I think with the added technology, or the technologies that we have at our disposal, are endless in many ways. As you were mentioning AI earlier, you know, but really thinking about what capabilities we have with 21st century technology. And speaking from my own experience as someone with a physical disability in STEM and in biology in particular, I spent a lot of time in academic lab settings where, you know, physical manipulation was such key to doing what was needed to do, whether it be to get a grade or to get, you know, past a course, or, you know, whatever I was ended up doing. But I vividly remember in undergraduate in particular, just kind of sitting in the lab, kind of twiddling my thumbs as I watched a lab partner, you know, physically manipulating an experiment, or, you know, collecting data, or, you know, doing something that, you know, in chemistry, for example, working under the fume hood. That one, for me, you know, I wasn't able to reach the fume hood or access the fume hood, but also, you know, in some ways was dangerous. You know, and so I would essentially, you know, have a lab partner, and everyone had a lab partner, but, you know, had a lab partner, and I kind of sat back and watched and observed, for better or for worse, right. And collected the data. You know, they'd read off a temperature, okay, 72 degrees, okay, you know, write that down. But what I would say is, when I really started cooking, if you will, was when I had the data and I could, you know, actually use that data to analyze the data. So I would say 95% of those lab experiences were observing, but the value for me was the 5% that I actually got to analyze and kind of use that data. And I'm not saying that it's it's invaluable to do the physical manipulation and to do the science, but really what got me going was, once you have the data, you know, the possibilities are essentially endless, or, you know, you're able to actually do that. So with you know, with the, well, one, just the sheer amount of data that's available,
right,
in our society today, I would have probably much better off, you know, have done more in that data analysis realm as opposed to kind of data collection realm. And I know there's some efforts in science to kind of move towards, you know, big data and essentially, you know, having access to all this data, you know, you can you know, you can create courses around, you know, data analysis and data analytics and these sorts of things. But if I could reshape my own undergraduate, in particular, you know, STEM education experience, I would much rather want to do things around data analytics as opposed to kind of this data collection piece of you know, sitting there and watching a lab partner. There's also a lot of effort into kind of automating a lot of these physical lab experiments and things. So, you know, so that can be another place of opportunity where, you know, no one wants to pipette 1,000 times anyways, you know, right. Whether you have a disability or don't, and whether, you know, my hands with arthritis and otherwise want to I want to be able to do that. But you know, if I need an experiment to run 1,000 times to get enough data, you know, how can we automate something like that to give you the data that you need to analyze for a particular experiment, but, you know, remove some of the barrier, physical or otherwise, for people with and without disabilities. So I think there's a lot of opportunity with the way with where science is going, with thinking about big data, data analytics, lab automation, you know, and really thinking about what it means to do, what it means to do science, and moving that beyond just being in the lab space, but also, you know, thinking about what the data actually, you know, are telling us.
Wow, I'm super fascinated over here. And also, I really appreciate you sharing the story, because people need access to the experience of the barriers, right? And the picture that you painted of like the tax on that task, right? And the limit because of the barriers for you just in that setting. So that's one end of the spectrum. But then you took us to the other end of the spectrum as it relates to big data and analytics and what could happen. And this ties back to what you were saying earlier, Logan. So keep me honest here when it comes to, if you have a person with a disability that has all this big data, right? They have access to that through their lens. The possibilities are still yet to be discovered. I mean, it's going to be far out there in terms of the amazing work that can be done through that additional refined lens, right? So and I just think that that's really powerful.
Yeah, and I will touch on what you were saying with barriers is there are I think an added element of barrier, or, you know, barriers that folks face, and in some ways they can pile up. So in my own experience, you know, and I knew I wanted to do science, you know, from, you know, even, you know, elementary, middle, high school, right? You know, I'm like, oh, I really want to do science. But there was always, you know, kind of something that came up that, you know, was an opportunity to pivot or to leave or to exit, you know, the kind of scientific, you know, career pathway, right? And whether that was, well, you know, going into my introductory biology or chemistry lab that, you know, as I was saying, you know, can't reach the fume hood or can't reach the lab bench, you know, that's one opportunity to, you know, to leave. It's, you know, it's going to a class and figuring out, oh, you know, I need to sit all the way in the back because the classroom is inaccessible. Okay, you know, that's another, you know, opportunity that, you know, I could leave. It's, you know, it's going into a research lab and, you know, figuring out that, you know, the lab space isn't gonna be suitable for, you know, my scooter or my wheelchair, right? You know, and that's another opportunity. So I think there needs to be, you know, some conversation around just these barriers as kind of opportunities to leave the discipline, which, you know, in reality is kind of where we see things like, you know, students with disabilities and retention or lack thereof, you know, kind of happen, and where we see students want to declare a STEM major, but, you know, not necessarily, you know, be a STEM major at graduation. So I think there needs to be some, you know, real conversation around kind of what are these barriers, you know, to be able to foresee them, you know, as we were mentioning. But then also, you know, starting to think about what are other, and not only alternative, but other, you know, career pathways for individuals with disabilities who still want to do STEM and do science, but, you know, doesn't necessarily have to be what we traditionally think about as a scientist, for example, you know, where we're, you know, in the lab with a lab coat, with lab goggles, right? You know, 21st century science is going to look a lot different than that.
Oh, goodness, Logan, that's so huge. This entire thing, the whole, you know, obviously I'm so excited about this. And what you had just mentioned, all of those points of failure, right? Potential points of failure for the institution that are seen as points of failure for learners. And there's this, you know, underprepared learners. And what you've highlighted is the ways in which, like I like to say, our structures and institutions are underprepared, right? To proactively and ill-suited in some ways because they have not proactively thought about and in control for these different pieces. And I just think it's huge. And I'm really excited about, you said, like you said, 21st century scientist or science and how it shows up. I remember there was this student that was really interested in, I think it was biology. And when we started to use the VR goggles, this was like not that long ago, it was like three years ago. Just the access to some of the information to even understand it, it didn't link. And once they were able to put those on and, you know, get in there inside a body in a cell, that person's now, I don't know if they're at what institution, I don't want to throw the wrong institution out, actually in veterinary, like pre-med school or something like that, some school. But the access, those reducing those barriers. And then another piece that came up for me when you were just saying is that, and I want to make this explicit, the outcomes, how the learning objectives, right? The programmatic objectives, right? Or what have you, goals and objectives and outcomes, they can be revisited as well, because traditionally they were seen as a certain thing and there are certain tasks that you are assessed on, your progress towards achieving whatever that is. And now there's an opportunity. And I really do, for me, you know, being, you know, instructional designer at heart, and more applying that to strategic planning and everything now, I really do think it comes down to recalibrating those as well, right? In addition to the career paths and spaces. And I don't know if you, I know you work for the Sheridan Center. I know you're really big into, you know, teaching and learning, et cetera. I don't know if you have anything to say about, as it relates to the actual ways in which we're designing our curriculum and designing programs and what opportunities there are there for that.
Yeah, I think that's a great point too, as you were talking, kind of recalibrating our learning outcomes and objectives for what it means to be a scientist in many ways, right? And
right,
you know, one of my, you know, if I were teaching, you know, introductory biology or introductory chemistry, for example, you know, one of my goals or outcomes would be, you know, how to critically think and how to analyze data and how to problem solve, right? And these are outcomes that, you know, are not necessarily things that need to be done in a traditional lab setting where someone's, you know, pouring, you know, 10 milliliters of water into a beaker and measuring it, right? You know, but really thinking about what it means to problem solve, what it means to critically think, what it means to you know, to be a scientist. So I think, as you're mentioning, kind of recalibrating some of these outcomes, but also recalibrating what practices we're using to get there. And I think this is, you know, a larger conversation, you know, an instructional design type of conversation, but, you know, but really thinking about the activities that you have students do, aligning with what outcomes you want students to take away. And I think there's, you know, traditionally a lot of mismatch in terms of, you know, what does, you know, a cookbook, what we like to call kind of a cookbook lab experiment, something that has been done, you know, time and time again. You know, some of the lab experiments that we do in basic science have been done for, you know, 50, 60, 80 years. You know, and kind of what value is that adding to a student's experience and, you know, and really kind of rethinking that towards something like authentic research where students are engaging in something that's novel or kind of meaningful in some way, shape or form. So, so, you know, this is kind of part of one piece of kind of a larger conversation of kind of what it means to prepare to become a scientist and how can we readjust the outcomes and also kind of the practices to align with that. And I think that's where there's a lot of opportunity to think about, you know, what does 21st century science look like and what does engaging with that as someone with a disability, you know, look like. And a lot of ways, some of the traditional things that we're doing have been exclusionary to people with disabilities. But what can we do to kind of reshape that to include, you know, more and more people with varying levels of abilities?
Oh, that's so, it's big. It's like life work, right? It's what you just mentioned in terms of, and this is in science and STEM, and then there are other areas that can follow that exact same outline, Logan, you know, in terms of where we are, which is totally, I'm big into like purpose-driven living and practice. And that's totally what I feel like I'm put on this planet to be in those spaces. I'm really excited about these types of conversations. And so I appreciate you sharing. And I do know that I would like to chat with you about so many topics, but I want to make sure that I honor your time and the time of the folks who are listening, because they're probably really excited and they want us to go on for another few hours. But I'm going to give you these two last points that I'm really going to touch on. I mean, really, it's one point. It's kind of like, you know, we started broad, we drilled into, you know, the very specific area of STEM, and then really even more so into outcomes. So I think the funnel is pretty awesome. And we're going to take it back out for a step just to provide you an opportunity. Are there any real life examples where the asset-based approach coupled with like the right tools or resources can make a difference in the lives of people that we didn't touch on, or student, whether in the workplace or in classes? Are there any other things to highlight that folks can, because the goal, as we're doing right here, we're adding to a paradigm shift, we're inviting folks to really consider, and sometimes those examples help even more. So I just wanted to provide that opportunity. If there's any other pieces that you weren't able to touch on that are, you know, apropos to our discussion today.
Yeah, just to add, and I'll plug this, and I'd be happy to share links or resources or more information, but I was actually had the opportunity to be part of a National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine panel, or essentially it was a working group on disrupting ableism in the workplace environment. So this is, you know, thinking about, you know, STEM or medicine or engineering, but really it brought together scientists and engineers with disabilities to discuss issues like these in academic settings, in industry settings, and really has laid some of the foundation of what individuals with disabilities envision a workplace environment to be like, and education environments to look like, to really envision what as I keep saying, a 21st century environment might look like, as we think about including individuals with disabilities. So that was just a really great conversation, and it was a 5-part series. But I would really recommend listeners to potentially take a look at some of the resources that are coming out of that committee's work, because it touches some on some of the legal components of and compliance kind of components of including individuals with disabilities. Talks about, as we've been discussing at length, the assets that individuals with disabilities bring. It talks about some of the mentoring and mentorship experiences of individuals with and without disabilities in these settings, and really just touches on kind of what needs to change in a lot of ways to, as the title is called, you know, as to disrupt ableism in these types of settings. So I would certainly turn folks' attention to resources like that. That was something that I had, as I said, again, the privilege and opportunity to be a part of, but really thinking broadly about other types of things like that for folks to really get a grasp or a handle on, you know, what it means to be an ally, to be an advocate, and be a, as that title suggests, you know, be a disruptor of kind of what it means to be ableist, and you know, to disrupt ableism, as I mentioned, or as I should say, and you know, and really thinking about moving beyond that to accessing ability, right, and accessing, you know, the most of everyone and their abilities.
Oh, that's, and that's a, I really do love that. I'm the resource, and then as you tied it up with a nice bow, the accessibility, you know, I'm over here smiling from ear to ear, Logan. Now the link, you're going to provide me with those links?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. I would, yeah, be more than happy to share. It's National Academies of Science, Engineering, Mathematics.
That's what's so
Disrupting Ableism is the title of that. And they're recorded panel sessions that folks could have access to, which I imagine many listeners who listen to a podcast like this would also be interested in.
Yeah,
that.
So deeper dive.
Would be more than happy to share.
It's like, you know, when you have the teaser text, like an article you can, or something, an abstract, you can go deeper into other areas. So I really appreciate that. So this is super exciting for me as we add to the resources and tools that folks can have to expand your paradigms. And I'm very thankful for you and your time here today, Logan. I you know, consider me as an ally, advocate. And I'm going to continue to power forward with, you know, using differently able and, you know, and also understanding that disability as a, and like when you started off at the very beginning, it's kind of like, you know, the words part and the semantics element and the, and being very focused on the work that we're doing to extend opportunities to reduce those barriers and the challenge that come from the challenges that people face, and look at the possibilities, and that's where we're going to be really heavy, and not only possibilities but the innovations. So this conversation today, you've provided a lot of, you know, really thick examples that can really help folks understand those possibilities. So it's not, and what is what's happening right now, so it's not just something that sounds good. And I wanted to make sure to close out with providing the space for, if we were to say, okay, this is the message that Logan, you know, wants the, you know, the world to leave with as it relates to this topic of, you know, accessing ability. What would be that thing that you would want educators, professionals, what would you kind of say you'd, and I know you, Logan, you and I, we invite people. We don't like urge people to do anything, right? We're like, hey, this is an invitation. But if you were to even go so far to urge everyone or a strong invitation to do, what would you say that you would want people to walk away from this conversation with, or as it relates to accessing ability? And I'm going to actually start that again, because my and I'll have to edit that out. What would you leave listeners with as a kind of call to action in terms of urging them to do, or more so inviting them to do?
Yeah, and I think you touched on it by saying, you know, inviting people in as opposed to, you know, pushing people out. And I think really inviting folks into this conversation around what individuals with disabilities bring, and what is, as we touched on, value added individuals with disabilities bring to conversations. I think there's often a conception that, you know, it is going to be challenging, and that, you know, in many ways is legitimate, right? But it is going to be challenging to, you know, to bring people into the fold. But really thinking about the opportunity outweighing the cost and the challenge of what that means, and you know, maybe it does take you know, a little extra time, or maybe it does take a little extra effort, or in some ways, and this is a real reality, but you know, in some ways some of these accommodations might take, you know, money even, but kind of reframing that in terms of what value it adds to a team, to a research group, to a classroom, to include the perspectives of individuals with disabilities can really reshape and kind of imagine, you know, what a classroom environment, a workplace environment, a research lab looks like if we do include a group that has otherwise not been included. So I just challenge and urge people to kind of think deeply and think critically about, you know, when we're making decisions or assumptions about what people can and can't do, you know, really thinking about what it looks like on the outside of what they can't do, kind of what it could mean they can do in terms of the possibilities of what it means to include someone.
That's beautiful. That is beautiful. And Logan, I really appreciate you for your time, because you know, it's very busy. It's busy season whenever the semester's here. So I just want to just genuinely appreciate you for the time, for your contribution to this space, and which what I think is game changing and earth shifting and transformational in all the ways. So thank you for your time today, Logan.
No, and I thank you for doing this work as well. This seems like a wonderful series that I'm really excited to be a part of. So
yeah, thank you, and thank you, listeners, those who are listening in. This is the Universal Love Movement podcast show with Dr. Carl S. Moore, and today I was joined by Mr. Logan Jin. And is it Jin or Gin? I haven't said
it. It's Jen, yep. Jen.
Okay, great. I'll make sure I said that correctly. Mr. Logan Jin, and we're hoping that you all recognize this this call to action by Logan here today, and that you're realizing more and more with all these episodes, whatever number you're on, that we all have unique genius and abilities that are waiting to be unleashed and unlocked. So let's go. Let's do this. And thank you all, and wishing you a very great day.